Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
When the protests finally end, the hard work in Egypt is going to start. How to rebuild that country's economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Yellow Book 360, offering a spectrum of marketing tools for small businesses designed to go beyond yellow. More at yellowbook360.com. And by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, today the 1st of February. Good, as always, to have you with us. Hosni Mubarak offered this political compromise today. He said he's not going to resign, but he's not going to run again when his term's up in September. That announcement came in a speech this afternoon. Whoever does follow Mubarak, and whenever that does happen, they're going to have some real fence mending to do, politically, of course, also economically. Marcus Noland is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Marcus, it's good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
We talked a little bit on the broadcast yesterday about the Egyptian economy today and how much trouble it's in. Do me a favor and flash back like a week ago. I mean, how was that economy and how was it functioning?
The Egyptian economy has actually not done badly over time. There's been steady per capita income growth. Improvements on social indicators have been quite impressive. Share of people in measured poverty is still high, but it's been steadily falling. So I think one would say the Egyptian economy had been doing pretty well. They were definitely benefiting from the boom in commodity prices. Foreign direct investment was way up in Egypt. So up until a week ago, while they still had some very serious long-run challenges, at least the short-run outlook was pretty good.
Lay out some of those longer-run challenges for me, would you?
Well, the basic problem they have is one of employment. They have, like other economies in the Middle East, a demographic bulge. So the number of new people entering the job force is about 4% a year. And so they have to generate jobs. Unemployment in Egypt is almost 10 times as high for college graduates as it is for people who have gone through elementary school. So they have a basic problem with unemployment, but particularly urban youth educated unemployment, and those are precisely the people who you see out in the streets.
Not to create a false equivalence here, but it's a little bit like trying to create jobs here in the United States. How does a government then, with that kind of challenge, create those jobs?
Ultimately, what they have to do is experience more successful globalization than they have to date. They need to be able to penetrate international supply markets, especially in industrial goods, that can generate a lot of employment. They have the advantage of proximity to Western Europe. They have free trade agreements with the EU. So they ought to be focusing on how they can expand manufacturers and services exports, especially to that rich nearby market.
Well, speaking of nearby markets, how important is the regional context for the Egyptian economy?
The regional context is important in the sense that Egypt's economy is very heavily tied to the Gulf. One of the problems the Egyptians face, and it's the same problem they face in Jordan and indeed in the Palestinian Authority as well, is that young college graduates have a choice. They can accept a job in Egypt or in Jordan as, say, working as an accountant. Or they can wait and hope to land a much higher paying job as an accountant in the Gulf or hit the lottery and get a visa and go to Western Europe or the United States. So oddly enough, the proximity of these countries that don't have enormous natural resource endowments, but their proximity to countries that do, increases their wage rates in Egypt, in Jordan, in Tunisia, and actually makes it more difficult for entrepreneurs in those countries to create jobs.
How much longer do you think there is, Marcus, in Egypt specifically, before the political crisis becomes a lasting economic crisis?
Well, the short-run disruptions have been obviously in the tourism sector, which is about a sixth of the economy, as well as the linkages to the outside world in both exports and imports. You know, it is going to get bad fairly quickly because of rising food and fuel prices. But really, those things will ultimately resolve themselves once you get political stability. But the important thing is whoever takes power after Mubarak is still going to face the difficult problems of employment and especially educated youth unemployment.
Marcus Noland, he's the deputy director and a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics in Washington. Marcus, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you.
So you say you want a revolution, but can you also deal with a downgrade Today, Standard & Poor's joined Moody's in downgrading Egypt's credit rating. They did the same thing to Tunisia after the street protests there. The downgrades make it more expensive for those two countries to borrow money, but the crowds in the streets, they probably don't care too much. Our New York Bureau Chief Heidi Moore explains.
The last thing people worry about in a revolution is who's going to pick up the check. But after the dust settles, political instability can be pretty costly. Just ask recently downgraded Egypt and Tunisia. Josh Brown is an advisor with Fusion Analytics.
Imagine if they have a Visa card and they're paying 18%, and all of a sudden the bank that issued that card tells them it's going to be 35% for the next 2 months. It makes it really hard for them to even consider new purchases or pay anything other than the interest.
Tunisia's central banker has complained that the ratings agencies rushed to judgment. But Moody's and S&P don't mind being politically incorrect. They ask mainly one question. Is this country going to be willing to pay back its debt? Any uncertainty can lead to a downgrade. Uri Dadouche is a senior associate with the Carnegie Endowment.
When people don't want to lend to the government, they typically do not also want to lend to borrowers in the private sectors or to the bank.
Neither Egypt's government nor its banks are open for business. So it's too early to say how expensive the downgrade really will be. Egypt's bond prices fell last week, but they are not moving much now. Investors are just waiting.
It's one of these countries where there's actual capitalism taking place. So I don't think anyone's counting on everything falling apart. I think a freeze is different than a collapse.
Egypt hasn't been a big international borrower, but the International Monetary Fund says it will support the country if the bond markets don't. I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, street protests? What's street protests? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This morning, BP announced it had lost almost $5 billion last year. That's quite a tumble from the $22 billion in profit that BP made in 2009. It's the price, if you will, of the oil leak down in the Gulf of Mexico. But today, CEO Robert Dudley announced that BP is going to expand its drilling, it's going to pay a stock dividend, and it's probably going to turn a nice profit in 2011. So after the mess in the Gulf of Mexico, is BP's rebound for real? From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Tro reports.
BP CEO Bob Dudley announced the company's first annual loss in 20 years, but he described the Gulf oil spill as last year's problem.
We went through things that no company ever wants to go through. We've internalized them.
Energy economist Gilbert Metcalf says yes, BP suffered, and yes, it's mostly recovered.
They're like the python that digested the large goat. The goat's through the system, and now they're back in business.
That goat would be the $40 billion or so BP is setting aside to pay for the oil spill. He says rising oil and gas prices have helped the company save that money more quickly. BP also sold more than $20 billion in assets, such as drilling rights and leases. It announced today it's selling two major U.S. refineries. Metcalf says BP knows a smaller footprint looks good to investors as well as regulators.
Solvent companies tend to be safer companies.
No one knows how much BP will have to pay in the end for lawsuits and government fines. The company acknowledges that. But Environmental Defense Fund analyst L.G. Holstein says BP won't be able to claim it's broke when the time does come.
Everyone now knows that they're in a financial position to pay what they clearly do owe for the environmental and economic impacts that they cause.
Holstein says under the Clean Water Act alone, BP could owe $4,000 per barrel of oil spilled. It's contesting government claims over how many millions of barrels wound up in the Gulf. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
You know how there's that urban legend about municipal plumbing systems during halftime at the Super Bowl worries about 100 million people all flushing the toilet at the same time? Well, you change the technology a little bit and the analogy holds for high tech come the big game on Sunday. There will be people tweeting about every touchdown and tackle. There will be cheeseheads on Facebook streaming videos of Steeler Nation waving those terrible towels. All of it guaranteed to use up a ton of bandwidth. And that might be just a hint of what's coming. Cisco released a new forecast today. By 2015, the company says data traffic will be 26 times heavier than it is today. And there will be more than 5 billion mobile devices worldwide. Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Suraj Shetty is a vice president at Cisco. In 4 years, he says we'll use a lot of data.
Almost equal to every person on Earth being able to send over 1,000 text messages every second.
Of course, it's impossible to text that much, but we will be watching movies, video conferencing, and doing, well, who knows what. Shetty says technology depends on infrastructure.
Whenever you put more bandwidth, new applications always find a way.
Analysts say video will account for 2/3 of data traffic by 2015, and billions of people around the world will buy smartphones and tablet computers. But that's just the beginning. Vending machines communicate with distributors. Cameras on buses send video footage to security guards. Charles Galvin is with Forrester Research. He says consumers should worry about strains on infrastructure and something else.
The impact it's going to have on their wallet.
He says service providers will have a new message for customers.
Usage has a consequence in pricing.
Industry analyst Chetan Sharma says the days of unlimited data plans are, well, limited.
Slowly and steadily, all the operators are marching towards a tiered pricing plan.
And they'll race to make their networks bigger and faster. It may be a challenge for consumers, but it's an opportunity for communications companies, including Cisco. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The umpteenth winter storm of the season is doing what winter storms do to a large stretch of the country today. It's going to keep on doing it tomorrow as well. Another big blizzard and another big cleanup bill for already tight state and city budgets. States and cities that are dealing with huge budget deficits. There's an idea floating around out there you might have heard of about one way to help states regain their financial footing. Just let those states declare bankruptcy. Commentator and business historian John Steele Gordon says history isn't kind to that kind of declaration.
There is a regular prescribed way for individuals or corporations to get out from under unsupportable debts and get a fresh start: bankruptcy. But while the Bankruptcy Code contains provisions to allow municipalities to file for bankruptcy, there are currently no provisions in law for a state to do so. The reason lies in our peculiar constitution. In most countries, there is what political scientists call a unitary government, which controls all political power. Even in countries with a federal system, political power usually flows from the top down. In both Canada and Australia, for instance, the federal constitutions give the states or provinces specific powers, with the federal government retaining the rest. But in the United States, it was the states that created the federal government, not the other way around. The 13 original states came together in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787 and gave the federal government certain powers, such as those dealing with foreign policy and interstate commerce. But they retained the rest. The 10th Amendment spells this out specifically. The American states, therefore, unlike the provinces of Canada, are sovereign, except insofar as they voluntarily surrendered aspects of sovereignty to the federal government. Why does this matter? Because this uniquely American concept of dual sovereignty makes state bankruptcy constitutionally a little dicey. To be sure, one of the powers the state ceded to the federal government was the power to write the bankruptcy code. The founding fathers were afraid that if the states controlled bankruptcy, deadbeats would simply skedaddle to another state, taking their assets with them and leaving their debts behind. So does the federal government have the power to prescribe the ways in which the sovereign states themselves go bankrupt? That's a good question, one that an army of lawyers are likely to wax prosperous figuring out the answer to.
John Steele Gordon's most recent book is called An Empire of Wealth. Write to us, please. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Coming up, changing the way cars are made.
My name is Shannon Bolin.
My name is Patty Tibbenham.
My name is Angela Harris.
My name is Ellen Lee.
My name is Debbie Molesky.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials sashayed past 12,000 today. The S&P left 1,300 in the rearview mirror. The Dow packed on 148 points, 1.25%, finished at 12,040. The S&P 500 added 21 points, 1.75%, closed at 1307. The NASDAQ up 51 points, 1.8%, 2751 at the bell there. A bunch of better-than-expected earnings distracted investors from Middle Eastern upheaval. Pfizer, UPS, and Archer Daniels Midland all beat earnings forecasts. Pfizer concocted a gain of 5.5% today. ADM fired up more than 6%. Profits soared 29% there last quarter because of growing demand for grain. UPS delivered an increase of 4%. It says 2011 earnings are likely to top pre-recession levels. Lexmark printed up 13%. Guess what? Yes, the printer maker reported fourth quarter earnings that everybody now beat expectations. The 10-year T-note fell. The yield rose to 3.44%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation.com, helping businesses and professionals monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. Reputation Defender is now Reputation.com. By Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Labor Department reports on unemployment rates in metropolitan areas for the month of December. The Senate Environment and Public Works Committee holds a hearing on drinking water and public health. And just how much more winter are we in for? Should be addressed tomorrow. It's Groundhog Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The January unemployment report comes out Friday morning, and given the trend the past couple of months, the general tone is probably going to be one of slow but consistent economic growth. But what you see depends on where you look. Last year, we talked to Dr. Julianne Malveaux. She's the president of Bennett College. She's also an economist. And we asked her about the state of the Black Union 2 years into a recession.
Well, the state of the Black Union is I think, on the brink and over the edge.
We invited Dr. Malveaux back to talk about economic recovery in the Black community, one of several conversations we're going to be having this month about the economic experiences of African Americans. Dr. Malveaux, good to talk to you again.
Good to be here.
On the brink and over the edge, as we just heard from last year, you still feeling that way?
I think it's even worse now. If the economy is recovering, it has not trickled down to working people, and it certainly has not trickled down to African Americans.
This is kind of a stretch. It's a heavy-duty word, but would you use the word depression for the African-American economy in this country?
Oh, emphatically. If you look at the official unemployment rate, it's 9.4%. But when you look at the BLS reports—
That's the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the government, the Labor Department.
Yeah, and the alternative measure for everyone goes from 9.4 to 16.7. For African-Americans, the unemployment rate is 15.8%. Using the same level of extrapolation, you get to 28%. 28% is a clear depression.
What then can the government do? I mean, the government's having enough time creating jobs overall. How can they concentrate specifically on the African-American community that would change things?
I think targeting, I think education and training, but targeting is important. It's not that a rising tide lifts all boats when some people are riding and some people are rowing. It's that you have to target the rowers so that they get to become riders. So you have to do something to ensure that African-American people have open doors to this economy. The way that we've seen economic recovery happen, and I would doubt that it's happened, but of course, traditional economists say it has, is you've seen a Wall Street recovery. You're seeing some of our larger businesses recover, but then the sequence is going to be next small and medium-sized businesses, then all workers, and then finally peripheral workers, many of whom are African-American. So you've got to change the sequencing.
If that sequence doesn't change, though, what's your guess as a professional economist as to when the African-American community in this country might see some kind of recovery?
I couldn't say. I mean, 2012 is when we expect to see the overall economy recover, but that means that for African-Americans, we're probably talking 2 years later.
And the odds of that happening in your estimation?
They're very low. They're not impossible. I mean, the challenge, of course, is that the president feels so very reluctant to target anything toward African-Americans for fear of being accused of favoring this community.
Do you think there's anything the president can do?
Absolutely. One of the things that's on the table, of course, is Jim Clyburn's 10, 20, 30 plan, which basically says recovery funds, 10% of them should be targeted toward distressed communities, those with 20% poverty or more, for the next 30 years. That would actually guarantee a stream of job possibilities to distressed communities, many of which are African American. That's one thing that government could do without putting black on the program.
So here's a subjective question for somebody who studies what is ostensibly an objective profession, that of economics. Are you at this point hopeful about the state of the black union?
You know what? That's a very interesting question. I just heard Chicago's Father Flager speak, and he described himself as a prisoner of hope. He said that even when the data was poor, he could not help but be hopeful, because if you cannot be hopeful, you really can't talk about change. So I would share that opinion that we have to be hopeful, but hope and a quarter will get you a paper. And so I am hopeful that the American people will be ignited by this economy to organize to improve it.
Dr. Julianne Malveaux is the president of Bennett College for Women in Greensboro, North Carolina. She's an economist as well. Dr. Malveaux, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Trucks and SUVs lifted Ford's fortunes today, specifically Ford's U.S. sales. They were up more than 9% last month as consumers chose bigger, more macho-looking vehicles to buy. For years, the auto industry has been a man's world, still is to a large degree. But Marketplace's Sarah Gardner visited Ford recently and found a research team that is entirely female. The Biomaterials Group is trying to make the interior of Ford's cars and trucks more recyclable, everything from the cup holders to the seat cushions.
My name is Shannon Bolin.
My name is Patty Tibbenham.
My name is Angela Harris.
My name is Ellen Lee.
My name is Debbie Molesky. I'm the technical leader of plastics research at Ford.
Meet Ford's material girls, as one of their colleagues affectionately dubbed them. This all-female team of engineers has 3 PhDs, 5 master's degrees, 8 Ford vehicles, and 7 children between them. All but one are Michigan natives, including team leader Debbie Molesky. She didn't set out to hire just women, but many are gravitating to environmental sciences, says team member Ellen Lee.
Especially in those having to do with materials and things that you can kind of touch and get hands-on.
Team leader Debbie Molesky comes from a hands-on family. Her dad welded parts on a Chrysler assembly line for 40 years. Molesky's been at Ford now for 25.
When you're young, you think the whole world's open. I'm going to move to wherever the best job for me is, and I'm going to be somewhere warm. And then you just fit in like a glove.
Molesky's driving me around Ford's hometown of Dearborn, just outside Detroit. We're in a new Ford Flex. It looks like a cross between an SUV and a station wagon, and boasts 2 biomaterials her team helped bring to market.
So here's the bin. It's hard to get to. And pretty much the third
Molesky
row
points to a built-in plastic storage bin back in the third row. It's been partly reinforced with wheat straw instead of glass fiber. Using the waste from a wheat harvest takes a lot less energy than making glass fiber. Wheat straw is also lighter, and a lighter car helps fuel efficiency. And then there are the seat cushions, backs, and headrests. They're filled with foam made from soybeans instead of petroleum.
So Ford is currently saving about 3 million pounds of petroleum each and every year by using soy instead of petroleum.
Ford now uses soy foam seats and backs in almost all of its models, including the Focus and its bestseller, the F-150 pickup. Molesky admits the real game changer for cars is replacing petroleum as fuel, but she insists every bit helps. Team member Patty Tibbenham says for years, the industry used plastic with abandon.
You know, the raw materials were so cheap that that was just what was used, you know, the plastics that were available.
That was true a decade ago when Molesky first started pushing bioplastics at Ford.
We would be invited to a meeting once, and then we never got invited back because when we pitched these things, people were like, really? Really? We're not putting that in a car.
But as oil prices started rising, bioplastics got Ford's attention. Molesky's team now tests all sorts of stuff to make car interiors: coconut hair, prairie grass, rice hulls, even old currency. But if the material can't pass a slew of company standards, cost, safety, durability, odor, aesthetics, it won't appear in a Ford vehicle. Team member Angela Harris hands me a shiny fabric sample for a car seat. Seemed good to me.
So you're telling me this right here is made of corn?
Yes.
What's preventing that from going into Ford cars right now?
So for this particular material, it is a durability issue.
High heat and humidity can make the material crumble. So this one goes back to the lab. It took 6 years to get the soy foam seat cushions to market. The first ones they cooked up smelled like rancid popcorn. Harris says the goal is to make these biofabrics last a car's lifetime, but then quickly degrade in a landfill.
That's the silver bullet. That's, you know, the holy grail we're trying to work for.
So, a compostable, petroleum-free car? Probably not in their lifetimes, says the team. They're just happy to drive the research forward while helping each other through life's usual mechanical breakdowns.
If someone has to pick up a sick kid early, one of us can cover for the other, and we kind of understand those things.
It'll be happening to me tomorrow, is what you're saying. If your kid's sick today, mine's sick tomorrow.
Okay? In Dearborn, Michigan, I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals. On the web at putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today from the Marketplace desk of how the heck does this happen? Bank of America has somehow become the most valuable banking brand in the world. Yes, that would be the same B of A. They got $45 billion in bailout money. The group that did the survey, London-based Brand Finance, figures that B of A, the brand, is worth more than $30 billion. It got there, the survey says, and this really is the best part, by promoting its role as a traditional Main Street lender. Goldman Sachs, by the way, in case you're curious, 16th on the list. Go figure. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow packed on 148 points, 1.25%. The NASDAQ up 21 points, 1.75%. The S&P 500 gained 51 points, 1.8% there. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. And that's where you can tune tomorrow for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time, back on The Big Show, Mood and Money.
Bulgaria is a reasonably developed country, so you would expect it to be very happy. But Bulgaria is sad relative to its income.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.